Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast whose episode titles are chosen in the backroom stitch-up. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and Steve Haynes, listeners, he's not here, I'm afraid. Steve has lost his voice, and losing your voice is pretty bad, as far as podcasting goes. Don't switch off yet, though, because we are joined instead by Charlotte Galpin, who is lecturer in German and European politics at the University of Birmingham. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Corey.
So it's roastingly hot here in the bunker. Jeremy Hunt is advocating bringing back fox hunting. Boris Johnson supporters are redefining liberty as the right to drink Coca-Cola without being taxed. And Labour's fourth place in the latest YouGov poll. Basically, listeners, we are in hell. This week, though, on the podcast, we're going to talk about the European Parliament. So the new European Parliament took their seats this week, and Charlie and I are going to have a bit of a chat about what it all means. So the week in Europe, Charlie, it started with a European Council summit earlier this week. What was that all about?
So the summit this week was basically to get the EU leaders together to finally decide on their nominations for the different presidencies of the EU. So the kind of big presidency of the European Commission, but then also the European Council president, the European Parliament's president, and the president of the European Central Bank. And this has been a kind of big question since the European Parliament election results, and the question of kind of whether the nominees for those presidencies would be those lead candidates, the Spitzenkandidaten, that the different European party groupings had put forward, or whether the EU leaders would propose someone different.
Right, yeah, and there's a couple of reasons for that, aren't there? So, looking back at the European election results from May, which we talked about on the podcast, but mainly in terms of how it affects British politics rather than European politics, bigger takeaway in terms of those results was that the big two blocks, so the Socialists and Democrats and the European People's Party, so they're the main centre-left parties, Labour Party and the main centre-right parties, apart from the Tory party because David Cameron did stuff. They've had a grand coalition essentially since the EU started.
Yeah.
And for the first time ever in those elections, they didn't get their big majority.
Yeah, at least for a long time. I don't know how far it goes back, to be honest.
I think it's the first time.
Probably.
If not, you know, feel free to email in and correct us. Because of that, I suppose it's hard for those two parties to ensure their nominations are put through because stuff like the European Commission president, so that's Jean-Claude Juncker at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
They need to be confirmed by the European Parliament, and it's a straight-up simple majority, I think, isn't it? And the Spitzenkandidaten system that you talked about, essentially that's the system where each of the big European Parliament blocs, so the Socialists and Democrats and the European People's Party, what's the Liberals call it? ALDE, I know is the acronym.
Changed their name to Renew, the Renew Party, I think. But they always have been ALDE, basically.
They've named themselves after their favourite breakaway centrist party. They should have called themselves Change EU, maybe.
Change EU, yeah.
The independent group. But there's them. There's the various other nationalist-y ones. They all have a lead candidate, and I suppose what happened in 2014, which I think was the first time it was put in, is that whoever got most seats in the European Parliament, the leader or the Spitzenkandidaten of that group would become the European Commission President. So Juncker became European Commissioner President because he was the Spitzenkandidaten of the European People's Party. And that didn't happen this time. So Frans Timmermans, who's a Dutch socialist, was the Spitzenkandidaten for SND, and I've written down Weber and haven't... I've forgotten his...
Manfred Weber.
Thank you. I was going to say Max Weber. No,
it wasn't Max Weber.
No, that would be a coup, wouldn't it?
That would be...
But Manfred Weber was the EPP guy. Neither of them got it. Instead, it was Ursula von der Leyen.
at least they've been nominated.
Oh, they've been nominated. So
they still need to be confirmed by the European Parliament. But yeah, exactly. The so-called Spitzenkandidaten have not been nominated by the European Council for those positions.
Shall we talk about von der Leyen first and then think about what that means in terms of the Spitzenkandidaten process? So, because it's an interesting one, because she's quite an interesting person anyway. I think was a singer and then came into politics in her 40s. But also Angela Merkel, I think, was the only leader not to vote for her nomination. Instead, Merkel abstained.
Yeah.
Partly that's because of pushback from the Social Democrats, who are part of Merkel's current coalition. But why is there a bit of pushback in Germany to her being nominated?
She's been a very kind of controversial character. She's been in government for as long as Merkel. She started as a families minister in the first CDU-SPD coalition, and then I think since 2005, or maybe a bit later, she's been defence minister. And in both of those roles, she's kind of been embroiled in a number of different scandals. As defence minister, there have been all kinds of controversies surrounding the awarding of contracts for military equipment. Recently, she's been kind of under fire for not doing enough on right-wing extremism in the army. As families minister, she was also responsible for putting forward a policy for kind of childcare benefits, which her critics said was a way to keep women in the home. And seen very much as something coming from the CSU, which is the more kind of Christian conservative Bavarian sister party of the CDU, to kind of push a particular family model. So she's quite an unpopular candidate, particularly I think on the left in Germany, but also in parts of the CDU as well.
Martin Schulz, who was the Social Democrats presidential candidate, wasn't he, I think, in the last German election?
He was their Chancellor candidate,
And he said that von der Leyen was the weakest minister.
Yeah.
And it sounds like there's been a few issues in the German army in terms of lack of troops and lack of equipment and what have you. But also interesting, reading up on it, the defence portfolio seems to have been a bit of a career graveyard for German politicians recently as well. A bit like the equivalent maybe of the Home Office here, which had a bit of a reputation of a place where careers went to die.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, defence in Germany is also a very, like, difficult issue to manage.
Why is that?
I mean, on the one hand, so von der Leyen has kind of presided over quite a significant increase in spending on German defence, and that's kind of also prompted by kind of Trump's accusations that Germany isn't spending enough on enough of its GDP on defence. She's presided over a lot of international deployments. But then, of course, Germany's always in this kind of double bind, that as soon as it does exercise military power or spend a lot on its military, then it's then criticised for being too aggressive or threatening, or kind of lots of references to its past, obviously. So it's a very difficult, I think, office to have, and the question of German participation in international conflicts is very controversial in Germany for historical reasons. And it's just a very kind of highly politicised.
But it was weird. So Bill Cash, I think, in PMQs this week, got really angry by just the fact that we had a German being nominated as the European Commission president, and was talking about how terrible it was that we have a German Europe. So heaven knows how it'd be if Germany actually met its NATO commitment of 2%.
Exactly, and that's something that's quite common, particularly in the UK, where Euroscepticism is very closely linked to this perception of Germany as always the aggressor, always trying to dominate Europe, whether that's through violent means before or now through economic means or through exercising its power in the European Union. But actually, this will be the first German president of the Commission since the 60s. Mm. So it's interesting that kind of...
I read Heroic Failure, which is Fintan O'Toole's book, on the British psychodrama that is Brexit. And he's particularly interesting on the the cultural side of it. So in terms of the fears over Germany, and I'd never really made a link before, but he talks about novels like Len Dayton's SSGB, which is set in an alternative world in which Germany wins the Battle of Britain and invades and takes over Britain, and how that's linked to British fears in the 1970s about German domination in Europe, and Britain being seen as the sick man of Europe. And then I think Fatherland by Robert Harris as well, which again is set in a world in which Germany is successful in World War II. And the fact that he wrote that in 1991 when people were worried about the reunification of Germany. And I've never really joined the dots before about the cultural anxieties behind this, Germany trying to make itself great again, and that how that anxiety plays out.
Yeah, and that's very much been part of the discourse on the EU in the UK. And then, so Thatcher, for example, linked her opposition to what she called federal Europe during the Maastricht debates to, slightly earlier, to her opposition to German reunification. So she saw German reunification as something that would make Germany too powerful in Europe. And then you only need to read tabloid reportings of Germany, and not even just tabloids, actually, or the EU. It's a lot of focus on Germany's role in the EU and the perception that it's Germany that's trying to take Britain's sovereignty.
Probably a lot of it from our soon-to-be Prime Minister.
Yes, a lot of it, definitely.
And we're not going to talk too much, I suppose, about other appointments. I mean, there's Christine Lagarde's going to become head of the European Central Bank, which is interesting given her role in the austerity, I suppose, in Greece. But not much has been made of that.
Yeah.
I think, which is interesting. And is it Charles Michel, I think, who's the new European Council president?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Belgian.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice to see a bald politician doing well.
But what is interesting is the nomination of two women for two of the posts, which is the first time ever women have been nominated. We've never had a female president.
There's never been a nomination at all.
I don't think so.
I suppose is it Kathy Ashton was the
foreign affairs? She was the
I suppose not the top.
So none of the presidencies have ever been held by a woman. So that's significant, I think.
And Donald Tusk said he's really happy with that because Europe is a woman. I feel there's a PhD thesis just in that sentence.
Yeah, well, we can actually also talk about that when we talk about the European election results, because a lot of the contestation over Europe and European integration has to do with gender and...
Well, should we do that now and then talk about the Spitz and Kevin? It's fine. Steve isn't here. We can do what we like.
Okay.
We can go all over the map. As long as I just tick off everything on this sheet of paper when we talk about it, it's fine.
We'll just have to follow our train of thought.
Yeah. Of what's being contested. You mean in terms of like women's rights, LGBT rights, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So it seems that... So European elections have kind of turned into also a struggle over the integration project itself and what the future of Europe should be, what Europe stands for. And we can see if we look at some of the debates that have happened or some of the parties that have been successful, we can see that a lot of this centres around, more broadly, it centres around values and the values of the European Union. So with right-wing populist parties, that has to do with immigration, Islam, but then also kind of generally social liberal values such as gender equality, LGBTQ rights, environmentalism. So we've also seen that the Green Party, Green parties across Europe have, or in many European countries, have did very well in the European elections. So there's a kind of struggle over like liberal values. And if we look at, for example, Italy and Salvini and Lega, that did very well in the European elections. A lot of his issues relate to what he calls gender ideology, or what a lot of far-right parties refer to as gender ideology, which is kind of they want to take us back to a traditional family model. They oppose women's reproductive rights. They oppose trans rights. In Poland, the issue of same-sex marriage and LGBT rights became an issue. In Germany, the AfD has always rallied against gender equality. Why I mention that is it's quite interesting that Tusk basically states that Europe is a woman, because it kind of signifies this idea that Europe stands for... So the European Union has for a long time tried to put gender equality as a kind of fundamental value of the EU. So it was written into the Lisbon Treaty that equality between men and women was a fundamental value of the EU. It's put gender mainstreaming at the heart of kind of EU policymaking. Much of this is a myth and it doesn't necessarily stand up to scrutiny in practice, but at least the EU itself is putting forward this kind of idea of itself as a gender equal institution. And so that then explains, I think, some of the backlash that we see from far right politicians.
So it's interesting. So you sent me something that you'd written on this and on the European elections itself. A lot of that backlash, and I suppose we, because we're a bit US-centric maybe in Britain, if we talk about it in terms of a culture war, really, on things like LGBT rights, women's rights, that sort of thing. But how in the European elections, it wasn't just about national narratives that were being played out. It was about Europeanising those things as well. So I think you mentioned the example of Marine Le Pen, who obviously, true to the Le Pen name, you know, very hardline campaign in terms of immigration, in terms of Islam, but talking about it on a European level, about the need to protect borders from refugees, and Salvini as well, talking about protecting Judeo-Christian values as well, therefore excluding any kind of notion that Muslims can be European. I made an offhand joke in the podcast a month or two, well, before the European elections, that in Britain, these might be the first European elections that were actually about Europe.
Yeah.
And I wonder, and I wonder if that... It seemed not everywhere, maybe, because so in Greece, Syriza didn't do very well because Alexis Tsipras has had a bit of pushback from the peace deal he's done with Macedonia. And Netherlands did particularly well because of Frans Timmermans running his campaign there, so that seemed to be quite nationalised. But how across Europe, it seemed to be, more a campaign about what it means to be European in the past, which maybe this false correlation causation here, but the fact that turnout was above 50% for the first time in ages, when I think people thought turnout might come down, is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I think we can kind of interpret that in some way as a kind of backlash against the backlash, because we've particularly since Brexit, there's been a lot of concern in other parts of the EU about the future of the European project, and that the European project is at risk of collapse. We've seen that far-right parties are doing well in particular countries like France and Italy in particular. And, of course, then you have Poland and Hungary and the questions around the rule of law. So I think that has kind of mobilised people also to try to protect the European project. So we, as I mentioned, like centrist, liberal and green, pro-European green parties did particularly well in these elections. So I think what this election became was also a battle over Europe and what does Europe mean and what should its future be. Yeah, it's a very different, I think, type of election than we've seen in the past, where they're very much in their national arenas and you might have nationalist parties. But what we've seen this time is that those nationalist parties are also communicating across borders. So Salvini, before the election, he made a big kind of media kind of spectacle about creating a far-right alliance for a different kind of Europe. And as you say, like a Europe that goes back to its Judeo-Christian roots, that is a Europe of nations, that has a particular set of values.
Is that partly because, as Brexit almost led to a bit more of not an existential crisis, because I think Europe seems to be coping with Brexit a little bit better than the British are, but has it led to a more existential questions being asked then about the kind of Europe people want to see?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, we've seen an increase in support for the EU in other EU member states since Brexit. And I think part of that is because Brexit presented the risk of an existential threat to the European project, and kind of then provoke these kind of discussions about how do we actually protect the project, how do we, what kind of future do we want for the EU?
And I suppose that's interesting because in terms of the results of the elections that we've sort of hinted at, the story beforehand was how big is that populist surge going to be? So how big is the Liga Nord's vote going to be? How big is Le Pen's vote going to be? how far is Macron going to get crushed? You know, how well is AfD going to do? Actually, that populist surge didn't really happen. I think it only went up from about 21% of the vote to 23% of the vote across Europe.
Yeah.
And instead, the big winners, as you say, are these centristy, green, liberal, pro-EU parties who were the biggest winners.
Yeah.
And they're the ones winning at the expense of the more established left-wing, right-wing parties. So in a British parlance, I suppose it's Remain the Tories voting Lib Dem and then more pro-EU people voting Green or Lib Dem rather than voting Labour. But that didn't just happen in Britain, that seemed to happen everywhere.
Yeah, and I think it's part of, the general patterns that we're seeing of these declines of the mainstream parties. For example, social democratic parties, in a lot of contexts, are struggling to maintain the levels of support that they enjoyed in the past. And I think partly is that they're parties that have struggled to figure out where they sit in terms of the new cleavages in politics. So it's not just about the left-right class dimension anymore, it's also about values and identity and where you stand on immigration and Europe. It's not just Labour that struggles with that question.
Actually, Labour booked the trend, Charlie. We got 40% of the vote in 2017.
How many so, in May this year?
We got about 40 votes. But no, 40% in 2017. Yeah. So it's fine. Just keep telling yourself that. Cry into your glass of wine later. And I suppose the other thing then is there's a bit of a, I don't really want to call it New Europe and Old Europe because it makes me sound like Donald Rumsfeld. But this idea that where the bulk of those pro-EU liberally parties were gaining tended to be in the UK, in France, in Germany, not exclusively. So I think Slovakia and Romania as well also had pro-EU anti-corruption candidates doing quite well. But then in the more sort of Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Hungary, Poland, it is the more right-wing, authoritarian, Italy as well, the kind of populist-y right-wing candidates. And I suppose this is where we can bring it back to the Spitzenkandidaten system and the reason why that failed.
Yeah.
Because Franz Timmermans was the Spitzenkandidaten of the Social Democrats.
Yeah.
And didn't get it. And one of the reasons he didn't, essentially, is because there was a lot of pushback from Hungary and Poland about the fact, essentially, he'd been saying, you're a bit authoritarian, guys, you have to stop this.
Basically, yeah. So Franz Timmermans, as vice president of the European Commission in the last parliament, was responsible for Article 7, the infringement proceedings against Poland.
I only know
Poland.
Article 50, I'm sorry.
It's the only article that matters in the infringement proceedings against Poland and Hungary on rule of law, and he's been very kind of outspoken about defending the European treaties fundamental rights. The main opposition to Timmermans was coming from the Central and Eastern European nations, Poland and Hungary, whose main demand was Timmermans under no circumstances. And that then led to this nomination of Ursula von der Leyen, because she became a candidate that was acceptable to those countries. And so what actually that means is that we're actually left now with none of the presidencies from Central and Eastern Europe. Usually there's also geographical considerations that there should be one president from all of the kind of different geographical areas. As European Council president, for example.
Feels like they're more willing to try and stop someone they really don't want than to try and get their guys into a particular seat. There was a talk of a Romanian politician as the High Foreign Affairs, but I've forgotten her name.
I don't remember her name. But what's, I think, worth noting is that any candidate from Central and Eastern Europe that would have been nominated would have been liberal and pro-European, which still would not have been really acceptable to the conservative governments in Poland and Hungary. So Tusk is very much quite a hated figure, I think, on the right in Poland, as that's kind of seen as a kind of enemy of the Poles or a kind of traitor of the Poles in that.
As far as traitor.
In the discourse, which is very, very nationalistic and very much about protecting Poland. I think that also explains why they were willing to forego having a Central and Eastern European candidate, because they were not likely to be a candidate that would stand for kind of their Eurosceptic conservative position.
It's when Viktor Orban finds someone who can be that candidate, that's when we start panicking.
Exactly.
Van der Leyen's appointment hasn't been confirmed at the time of recording, but assuming it is, there has been a bit of pushback from the from some people in the European Parliament talking about the fact that they don't like the fact that it's seen as essentially undemocratic, it's seen as a bit of a backroom stitch-up. Because the idea of, I suppose, the Spitz and Kandidaten was to try and bring a little bit of an accountability and a bit of a face to the process of European democracy. So there are debates in English, aren't they? And all the candidates kind of make their pitches.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the German MEPs was talking about how there are posters of all the candidates out, towns and cities, to try and persuade people to vote for them. Certainly in Britain, I think it has very little impact. I know it's, as part of the Labour campaign, we talked about it in a way of trying to get people to vote for Labour, to say we want a socialist president with socialist ideas. But it's not something that was really taken on, even by the National Party, really, didn't talk about that. Does it say anything about where power lies in the European Union in terms of the European Parliament or heads of member states or the electorate? Does this process kind of shed any light on those kind of debates?
I think it's definitely part of a kind of power struggle between EU institutions. So the European Parliament for many years has tried to increase its power within the EU as the only institution that represents European people. It's the only directly elected institution. European Parliament has consistently pushed for ways to make the European Union more democratic, the European election process more democratic. And this goes, the Spitzenkandidaten system goes back to the Lisbon Treaty, when a very vague commitment was made, demanded by the European Parliament, that stated that the European Council, in nominating candidates for Commission President, would take into account the results of the European elections. The European Parliament then interpreted that to mean that all the parties would put forward their lead candidates, their Spitzenkandidaten, and that candidate, the candidate of the winning party, would become European President. Now that happened in 2014, so Juncker was the lead candidate for the EPP, and the EPP won the most votes. There were still these debates going on in 2014, but particularly in Germany, there was a huge backlash against the idea that the Spitzenkandidaten wouldn't become Commission President, that it would be affront to democracy. But actually, the process has not really worked very well. So it's mostly been successful in countries where one of the Spitzenkandidaten is a national. So, for example, in 2014, the two main lead candidates were Juncker, who speaks fluent German, and Martin Schulz, who is German. This year, I think you already mentioned that in the Netherlands, this obviously is with Frans Timmermans as the candidate for the S&D, they really got into this process. But in countries like the UK and other parts of the EU, there's very little attention paid to this process. The campaigns are run by national parties. There's very little name recognition of any of the lead candidates. So there's really a question about how legitimate these lead candidates would be or be seen by European citizens.
Partly a little bit of a pushback to the European Parliament and saying they almost, it was not quite a power grab, but trying to make it a little bit more powerful than it was, and they're almost being told to get back in their box a little bit.
Yeah.
And I suppose also, if you've got to think about appointing four presidents, and you've got to think about gender, geography, views, acceptability to leading candidates, it's going to be really hard to find four people who do that, especially if one of them's already nailed on as a president. So I suppose in terms of, if we think about, you know, democracy and politics, like part of the, I suppose what we're finding with the Brexit vote is there's a difference between democracy and politics, and democracy isn't just like one vote that then decides everything else that happens after that. So maybe, you know, part of politics is about horse trading between different people afterwards, and it's not surprising that happens at a EU level, because that's kind of how it's got to work.
But then it's also about how you, about framing. So is it horse trading or is it consensus? Because you could argue that this is a consensus, kind of consensus, process of consensual decision making amongst the national leaders of the EU member states. And maybe it's more perceived as more legitimate by people that their national head of government is involved in that decision than the European Parliament, which is seen as quite remote. Or these candidates also don't... I mean, one reason why people opposed Manfred Weber becoming Commission President is that he's never been in government, he has very little experience, he doesn't have really any name recognition, he's not a very charismatic figure. So there's a question of whether they've actually chosen candidates that are able to kind of inspire people or be seen as legitimate.
That's a much better way of putting it, yeah, building consensus. it's the consensus that we should stop. Right, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with or without Steve. In the meantime, we have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. And our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. My Twitter handle is @paperbackrioter.
I'm not on Twitter. You can find my stuff on the internet, but yeah, I'm not there.
Just Google. That never went wrong for anyone.
Google me.
James Cram designed our logo, and Dave Depper is responsible for our theme tune, Pookie Good Times. Happy plotting!